Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Just heard our first guest, Annie Haslam, the lead singer for Renaissance with their 1978 hit Northern Lights. Haslam is legendary for her five-octave range and angelic voice that's led many to proclaim her the queen of progressive rock. When I was a teenager listening to much heavier bands like Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, it was Annie's voice in the classically inspired artistic music of Renaissance that literally moved me to tears in a performance at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles in 1977. We'll talk to Annie about her amazing career. Later on in the show, we'll also hear from Brazilian-born musician, artist, and engineer Daniel Belker about his use of vibrations to bring the experience of music to the deaf. As we'll find out, it may not exactly be music at all, but a new form of art, all its own, as we'll hear about his use of vibration-producing or haptic vests at concerts. But first, our guest is one of my favorite singers of all time. Annie Haslam, lead singer for the band Renaissance. While Renaissance might not have achieved the major label popularity of progressive rock titans like Yes and Genesis, anyone, me included, who went to their live performances came away with a deep appreciation for the artistry of Renaissance and the beautiful voice of Annie Haslam. In recent years, she's also become well known for her beautiful artwork produced at her home in rural Pennsylvania. She joined us from there recently. Annie Haslam, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you very much.
I have to tell you a brief story. I retired from being a high school science teacher a couple of years ago. And in my last years there during COVID, kids were, you know, they were hungry for some kind of extracurricular activities. And I happened to play some prog music for my classes just for fun to see what they would think of it. It was Siberian Katru. It was a cover of that song by Yes. And there was a group of kids that just really reacted to that. And one of them sent me an email and said, "Mr. Schloem, is there more music like that?" And I said, "Oh, yes, there's quite a bit like that."
Yeah.
And so I said, "You know, if you're really brave and you promise to listen to it three times all the way through before you decide whether you like it or not, I would recommend that you listen to the entire album, Close to the Edge, by Yes." And she did. And she loved it. And then she said, "You know, we've got to listen to more music like this. And I have some friends that, you know, we really like this. Can we start a prog rock club, Mr. Schloem?" And I'm like, "You've got to be kidding." Now these are girls, 15 years old, and mostly Hispanic girls from a very rural area. And they just fell in love with this music. So every Friday, I would play them progressive rock music for a couple of hours after school. And listen and watch their chat comments. And they were hilarious because they'd never really listened to the Beatles ever. And they fell in love with the Beatles. And then, of course, I would play Renaissance for them here and there. And after a while, they picked up on something. One of the girls in the chat said, "Mr. Schloem, did you have a crush on Annie Haslam?" And I said, does the sun rise in the east?" And then fast forward, I do a musical group with a bunch of friends of mine from all over the place. But we're a small group of about 15, 20 people that love the same kinds of classic rock music. And we have our niche of prog rock that we play, the prog rock block. And I've played, you know, a lot of stuff for them. And then a few weeks ago, one of the ladies said, "You know, I think Dave has a crush on Annie Haslam." And she said that, and I said, "Yeah, I do." So I wanted to let you know that when I was 16 years old, I went and saw you and Renaissance and Gentle Giant at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, March 31st, 1977. And I fell in love with that lady in white with that incredible voice. And it was just, I remember at the end of one of your songs, I can't remember exactly which one it was, but I just had tears coming down my face and I didn't know why. It was just so beautiful.
What year was that?
1977.
It could have been Scheherazade because I do a very kind of.
I think it was Scheherazade.
That's a very emotional piece of music. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's phenomenal, really.
You know, Scheherazade is such an epic piece. It's like 20 minutes long. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, what it's like to, you know, be a part of a composition like that and to perform it on stage?
Oh, it's incredible. I think it's actually either 25 or 28 minutes.
Yeah, it's long.
Something like it is long. Yeah. Oh, God, I remember like highlights. I mean, it was just being in the studio and working with an orchestra to hear your music with an orchestra is very emotional. John Tout, who was the original or second original keyboard player, he and I were the most emotional, and we'd be standing there and holding hands. And when the orchestra came in, it was just like floods of tears, and the choir, you know, it was, but the piece of music, it was incredible. And Mickey did his best to make it into a musical later on, but unfortunately, you worked on it several years, but it didn't happen. It's such a huge undertaking to do that, you know. But it was, oh God, I was so proud of it. I mean, I didn't write music for the band. I did put a arrangement ideas in for sure, but the main part of the musical was Michael Dumford writing the music and Betty Thatcher writing the words. But having said that, you know, Terry Sullivan did write some parts of the music. This is the whole album, all through Renaissance, really. And then John Tout did a huge amount of piano work and writing piano work that he actually didn't get enough credit for. But I would say it could be our best piece. It's
stunningly beautiful. We'll return to Carnegie Hall in a bit, but I want to back up a bit because your origin story is truly unique, because you were interested as a young lady in becoming a fashion designer and doing design.
Yes.
And not singing. That was not part of your life plan. Could you tell us how you got to, from there to all of a sudden, you know, a few years later, you're one of the most, you know, famous singers in the world?
You know, it's kind of strange. I went to art school in Cornwall for about 3 years, I think it was, something like that, to be a dress designer. And so I went to another college that was a kind of not attached to it physically, but just up the road, where you went for pattern cutting and pattern making, you know, so you design something and then you go to somebody else to learn how to sew, basically. That was interesting. And also one of the classes was fabric printing. So you'd do printing, and then also weaving was another one. And then I did typography, you know, typesetting and things like that, which was interesting. And photography, because I went to a secondary art school in Bolton that did academic subjects and art, and my parents could see that I was gifted in that way. And instead of me going out to work, which they really needed me to do because we were a working class family, they supported me and suggested I go to art school, which I didn't think of. They could see it though, and they sent me to elocution lessons, which they couldn't afford, but they knew, they must have known instinctively I would need to be able to speak and sing with a perfect English accent. And so that my voice changed, because I used to talk like this, you're right.
Yeah, yes.
Come on then, let's have you, you know. and so anyway, But I didn't know that. And I thought, why are they sending me to this woman who's teaching me to go, you know, and father's car is a Jaguar and pa drives rather fast, you know, all these things. And I was a little girl and I thought, what are they doing to me? But I had no idea, but they were getting me ready for what was coming later on. And we moved to Cornwall and that got me away from the school bully, which was a lifesaver. I had a school bully for at least a year. Ruined my life. And we moved to Cornwall, which was like moving to Florida. We went by the sea. It was like a gift from God. And down there, I went to another art school. Now, in that art school, which was near, it was in Redruth in Cornwall. And I remember the older students, I remember particularly a girl called Vicky Hughes, beautiful. She was tall, she was older than me, long blonde hair. And usually in the lunch times or when we had a break, she used to sit on the stairs with some other people and somebody and a guitar, and people would start singing. She would sing, you know, and it was amazing. But I I just loved it. I didn't think, oh, I'd like to do that. And at the same time as that was going on, my brother Michael was being discovered by Brian Epstein, and Brian became his manager for a couple of years.
Manager of the Beatles.
I knew Michael could sing, you know. Obviously, my dad was a amateur comedian singer, so it was in the family. So Michael was the singer, but again, I still didn't even think. And then I had a boyfriend later on called Eric Peacock. This was when I moved up to London, and he could, so when we'd go to parties and things, he'd hear me, if I had a few glasses of cider or something, he'd hear me singing along. He said, you know what, we should put you in for talent competitions. And that was the start of it, really. And then my brother's girlfriend heard me. She was a singer, and she heard me singing along with the outro music from The Saint, you know, Roger Moore.
Oh, yeah. I used to love that show.
That bit there. And she said, Annie, I didn't know you could sing like that. And I guess she heard something, even in just the notes I was singing, you know. She said, you need to go and get your voice trained. You need to go to the Harold Miller. She'd been to him. He taught Shirley Bassey. Do you remember Shirley Bassey?
Yes, of course.
Oh, what a voice.
Oh,
my God. If nobody's heard of her, they have to look her up. That voice was a God-given gift. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And so I went to see him. I went to see him in the evening in a week studios in London. And I got there and he said, do you read music? And he's a very nice man. He was an older man. And I said, no, I don't. I'm afraid. Sorry. Then he said, well, do you know I could have danced all night? And I said, yes. And he said, well, if I play the piano, can you sing it? And I sang it. And he said, your voice is beautiful. It's different. He said, I would love to teach you, but I only teach in the daytime. And I had a day job, so I couldn't do it. And that's when he put me in touch with Sybil Knight, who was a teacher, and she'd been an opera singer as well. And that was it. That was the beginning of me finding my five octaves and also finding my own voice, because I was listening to Joan Baez for years. I bought a songbook and I'd just sing along, you know, not thinking I was going to be a singer. In fact, I got to meet her twice now. And the first time I met her was just around the time when I got breast cancer and my hair was short I got backstage to meet her, took some flowers, and she knew who I was, which was the weirdest feeling.
Of course.
I didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
I was so starstruck, you know.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
Oh my God, it was just what a thing to meet her after all those years.
Yeah. Well, Annie, you really are an Eliza Doolittle for reals.
Yeah.
You, right down to singing, I could have danced all night.
Well, and also I was thrown out of the school choir for singing too loud. You know, so that, but I didn't know then, you see, but I obviously somebody up there in heaven or the universe knew it, you know.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with British prog rock singer Annie Haslam from the band Renaissance. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. If you're just joining us, that was our guest, Annie Haslam and Renaissance, performing on the Midnight Special from June of 1977. Let's get back to our recent conversation with her from her home in Pennsylvania. How do you hook up with Renaissance? Because it's always interesting to me, especially in England and London at that time, because it was such a time of musical fermentation, yeah, that, you know, people would meet at clubs like, you know, Chris Squire and John Anderson, and the next thing you know, boom, Yes is born.
Yeah.
How did you get hooked up with your bandmates?
Yeah, I started, Eric Peacock, you know, as I said, we did all these talent competitions, and I'd win them, but I was really not, like the other singers were a bit busty, you know, and they always showed the boobies and, you know, the tight dresses and high heels, and that wasn't never me. It's not me now. I've never been like that. And so, but I had long hair parted in the middle. I used to wear short dresses, but not, you know, not showing anything and wearing big high heels and everything. But it was my voice that won, which was great. But I remember in this London club in the East End of London, it was really loud in there. And I was a bit scared when we went in. I thought, oh, I'm going to feel awkward here. Well, they had ultraviolet lights over the stage, and I had a dress on, and I didn't realize that you could see through it if you put an ultraviolet light on it. So I had white underwear on that everybody could see, and all the guys were cheering like, oh my God, they love me, you know. they like my bra and pants. That's what they liked. It was the funniest thing. But I mean, I knew better after that. You go through all these different things when you're younger, you know. It's good to go through bad things as well as good things, so you're prepared for, you know, that's how you learn.
Yeah, you have to learn to find.
Yeah, you can learn it. So anyway,
find yeah, dresses that are opaque to ultraviolet light.
Yeah, and then a job came along. My first singing job was in a cabaret group called the Gentle People, and it was three guys, a bass player, drummer and a guitarist, and they needed a girl singer, and so I went for the audition. They fiddled when they first saw me. The second audition was to be, they really loved me, but when they, there was another one for that had to be an audition in front of the owner of the club. And so what they did is they fiddled the timing so that the other singers got there late. And it looked like I was the only one who turned up, and I got the job. But he loved my voice anyway. But there was competition there, like, because it was a dinner theatre. One of the other singers might have got it because they were the more shapely ones. You know, I wasn't like that. It was, again, it was all about my voice. It wasn't about, you know, how big my boobs were and, you know, all that kind of thing. And so that was a fabulous time in my life because, again, you know, it's all experience, but sharing a room with all the dancers, you know, and we went on when people had dinner, and then the main act came out, you know, different people, a variety kind of show. And then after that, we went back on stage for people dancing, you know. It was so much fun. I can't tell you. And my mum and dad came up from Cornwall to see me, and I was told afterwards that somebody overheard my dad, when I was singing, turned around to somebody on the next table and said, "That's my daughter up there, Anne. My daughter Anne up there. And she's better than Barbara Streisand, you know."
Well,
oh, no. God. Yeah, I just, you know, these certain things that you remember. But anyway, sure. The guitarist one day said to me, "Annie, I've just found this ad in the Melody Maker." And the Melody Maker was, you know, one of the biggest, along with New Musical Express, the magazines, you know, the paper magazines, music magazines of the day. And there was an ad. He said, "I've seen an ad." And he said, I think you should go for this. I think I've been there about 9 months at this point. And he said, "You know, Annie, you're wasted here. Your voice is, it should be, you know, it deserves more." And so anyway, it was, I think it was that it said, girl singer wanted for international pop group.
There were a lot of those ads that musicians would answer, and you know, and then great bands would be born from those ads.
And so I called up, and the band were away in Europe, I think. It was a six-piece band then. The lead singer was the main singer, and they wanted like a kind of another singer as a backup singer, not really as the lead singer. Of course, that changed, you know, a few months afterwards. But then the audition, I learned everything on the album. They told me the album, I bought it, I learned everything on it back to front. When I got there, Michael Dumford was there, John Tout, Keith Ralph and Jim McCarty were there. And it was like in a little church hall. I think it was in Weybridge, either Addlestone or Weybridge. I never get that right. And it was New Year's Eve, 1970. And I looked the part. I got a long tapestry Bieber coat on, and my hair was parted in the middle, and I had a Bieber dress underneath. You know, and I knew all the songs. And they asked me to sing Island, and they called me the next day, and I got the job. And what we did on this last, in 2019, when we did our 50th anniversary tour with our own orchestra, which we have now, we flew over Jim McCarty, who obviously started Renaissance with Keith Ralph, flew him over, and he joined us on stage to perform Island, some that got me the job.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was fantastic. So, yeah, it was Eric Peacock is the one that was started it all off. And also, you know, a few people, I guess, but he was the main one for Catalyst, I think.
And then when you get to like what a lot of people think of is the classic Renaissance lineup of like 1971 to the end of the decade of the 70s. Do you remember when you first realized this is a really special band?
Well, I think I felt that when I first went for the audition. I was a bit shy, believe it or not. Can you believe it that I was ever shy? But I was a shy little girl, you know, and shy, you know, very naive. I hadn't really been in the business, particularly with a rock band, even though it wasn't heavy rock. And so when I got the job, New Year's Day, 1971, I think it was only like 3 or 4 weeks later that we were in Germany. We went on tour in Germany. I was terrified.
Well, Renaissance is really a unique setup because it doesn't have a lead guitar.
No.
You know, the wonderful lush piano and keyboards, your voice, which is just, you know, to me, the signature of Renaissance, and then, you know, great bass playing and percussion and some acoustic guitar and singing. But it really has such a kind of a symphonic sound to it. Did you love classical music when you were growing up? And did you realize you were going to be playing music with that influence?
Well, Eric Peacock again, Eric, good old Eric. When I was with him, I learned how to, I went mountain climbing with him, and what you call spelunking, we call potholing in England, going underground.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We did caving.
All these unbelievable, oh, thank God I did them then, because what an experience. And so he introduced me to a lot of things. He was a graphic designer, which was interesting because I was artistic. But Eric played, I know he played the piano a bit, but he introduced me to classical music. Basically, it was him. And Vaughan Williams was one of his favorites.
Ooh, which one of mine.
Absolutely loved. That one with the violin concerto in it. Mm-hmm. I remember what it's, oh my God, it just makes you weep. And so that was before I joined Renaissance. I wasn't looking for a classical rock band, you know. I think when we were living together, one of the first two albums that we bought were King Crimson, In the Court of the Crimson King. And funnily enough, I end up with John Wetton became a close friend of mine, which was interesting. And then, but the other one was ELO, the first ELO album with Roy on it. And of course, I ended up engaged to Roy in 1975, you know, spent 4 years. It's so weird. All these things happened. Like these just, they're almost like signs, you know, then I look back and think, oh my God, look at that. And the first song I sang in public in a pub in Toronto, my mum and dad took me to Canada. I was heartbroken by this this company called Winsmore, who stole my designs when I was dress designing, my designs and fired me after taking my book.
They took your designs and then let you go.
They took my designs, and I was heartbroken. I called my mum and dad, and they were going to Canada. They said, right, you're coming with us. So I went there for a month, I think it was. Fabulous time, because my brother Keith had moved out there. And we went out drinking in Toronto to the Brunswick Tavern, and everybody was drinking lager then. You know, that was the drink of the day. And I remember I had a couple of large glasses of cider. And then I think at that point I'd started doing some of the singing in the pubs, you know, the talent competitions thing. So, and because Eric was, so I was still involved with Eric then. And so they had all these songs written on big pieces of cardboard, you know. And so my mum and dad said, why don't you get up and sing? And I thought, oh, no. But the thing is, because I had two glasses of lager, I was kind of feeling a bit, you know, stronger, you know. Oh, God.
A little bit less inhibited.
And I got up and I sang Those Were the Days. And I won this little talent competition, you know. It was probably more lager. I don't know what the prize was. But then again, you know, that was produced by Tony Visconti. And I ended up with Tony Visconti writing songs with him and producing my albums.
It's so interesting to think back at, you know, something that seemed terrible at the time, your designs being stolen. That is awful.
Yeah.
But it pushes you into the direction that you were supposed to go, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is music. And so let's fast forward a bit into the prime of Renaissance and those three concerts at Carnegie Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Because that live album, if you want to check out Renaissance, I highly recommend you get that, because you can find that on YouTube, Amazon, all kinds of places.
Yeah.
It's just an incredible recording. Could you tell us a bit about what it was like for you guys to be playing at Carnegie Hall? Because you were one of the first, you know, rock type acts to do that.
I think we were the first rock band, weren't we? First or second to play there. Yeah, because we did get some bad press. We got some good, but somebody wrote something, you know, the bad press always seems to get more attention, doesn't it? Just saying that we were too loud and everything. But, you know, if you listen to that album, it's just really, you're right there. I mean, the atmosphere is really fantastic. But it was like, pinch me, you know, is this really happening? Because I joined the band in 71, and in 4 years, 75 were at Carnegie Hall. I mean, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And sold it out three nights in a row.
I know. And it was just, we had a rehearsal, I remember, with the orchestra. And I think it was Tony Cox that was, I think he arranged one of the albums. It could have been Scheherazade. But he was there to conduct the orchestra. And so we had this big rehearsal room with the orchestra and the choir. And I remember this very well. We get there and the choir come up to me like asking all these questions because I was the lead singer. Well, I don't read music. I don't write music. So I felt a bit like kind of naive and stupid, to be honest. But Tony Cox kind of came in and saved me, you know, whatever. I just didn't want to look like I didn't know anything. But they looked to me as the leader of the whole thing, of the choir. And because I thought that they would have a choir leader. But anyway, whatever happened, it was okay. It's one thing that stood out in my mind. I thought, if ever that happens again, I can't let that happen again, you know, to be like in that situation. But oh, that was exciting that day. It was like, you first of all, you go in and you listen to the orchestra tuning up, and that's on its own is so exciting.
That's magic.
Whoever you go and see, whatever orchestra you see and you hear them, it's that part is just as great as the rest of it, you know. And so the three nights, it was all the fans that came were all dressed up. Normally they'd be wearing jeans and t-shirts. Everybody was dressed up to the nines. And it wasn't, you know, not like it is now. I remember we'd be going out of the stage door like they did in the old days, and then people there, and you could sign a certain number before somebody said, come on, now we got to go. They have different things where they have the meet and greet. Well, not so many people do that anymore because of the pandemic, but I can't explain. It was one of the best moments in our career and lives, and that the album as well is just phenomenal.
It's really well recorded. It's a shame that it was not filmed.
You know what? We didn't film anything. I don't know why. Obviously, maybe the budget would have been too much. You know, they had to pay for orchestra. Who knows? I've no idea why. It's the same with the Albert Hall. We did the Albert Hall, sold that out. That wasn't filmed.
Well, and but one last thing is I've noticed also with a lot of artists from the 70s and 80s that they're really spending a lot of marvelous time collaborating together and in their later years. And you've collaborated with some of the greatest musical artists ever. And I hate to put you on the spot and say who's your favorite or anything like that, but are there a couple of special experiences that come to mind of collaborations that you had with somebody that was not in Renaissance over the years, like some really special ones?
Yeah, it's like asking me what's my favorite album.
Yeah,
it's like every person is different.
Yeah.
I've done several things with Steve Howe.
I love Turn of the Century. Woo, yeah, that's beautiful.
Turn of the Century. And It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, because he's got an album of Dylan songs that he did, which are that's a fantastic album to get. Yeah, and we did actually write some songs together back in, when was it? Let me think. 95 or 97, I'm not sure which it was. But anyway, I went over to England and we wrote some songs together. But when I was there, he got a call from John Anderson, and he said, I'll be on the phone for a bit. So I was on the phone for about 2 hours and then came back and said that they were getting Yes back together. And I thought, and because the project never happened, they never did it. It was a shame because it was magic. Oh my God, I'll tell you, it was magic.
World's greatest guitar player with the world's greatest voice, yours.
Yeah, but I of course we're both vegetarians, so we did have some things in common, but it was a great, it was an adventure working with him and doing that. And then Turn of the Century is fantastic.
Oh, it's such a beautiful song.
Good.
The original by Yes on Going for the One is gorgeous, lush, beautiful song. Yeah. So I would not have thought, like, how could you cover this and make it, as good or better or whatever. It's a little different, but it is beautiful. I've played that song for many of my friends and they all love it.
I think that, when John left Yes, when they were talking about they were going to get, my friend, actually he's a friend now, Roger Dean.
Great artist.
He suggested me, to be the new singer of Yes.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I could hear that.
But it would have, anyway, it didn't happen. I think there was too political or whatever whatever it was. It doesn't matter because that would have been a huge thing for me to take on. And I don't play any instrument. So I think John Davidson that they have is just perfect.
Yeah,
for the band,
These things work out for the best.
And the other thing I did with Steve was we did It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, and I sound like Joan Baez on it because I sounded like Joan Baez until I had my singing lessons.
Oh, how fun!
That's how I sang it. It was me, but it sounds like her. And then also John Wetton,
King Crimson.
I always wanted to work with John. Our voices together, and I did sing on this song that he had called In the End, which was by Icon with Jeff Downs was a project they did together. But then when we did our album Grandine Il Vento, Mickey and I wrote a song and I named it Blood Silver Like Moonlight. And I was told by a clairvoyant lady, a friend of mine who's a very, very gifted lady, and she said that John and some people might laugh at it about this, but some won't. But this is what she said, and I truly believe it, is that, and because John's voice is unique, is different, and so is mine. But she said, you and John sang in the angels' choir together, and we're both seraphims. She was very adamant of what we were, right? We sang together in the angels' choir, and so that's what this song is about. It's called Blood Silver Like Moonlight, and it's me and John singing together. And that's a nice one to listen to if anybody's interested. That's on Grandine Il Vento album. You can get that on our you can get it. There's so many places you can get things now, but on our website, you know.
Gosh, on that note, I think that's the perfect place, because I've always felt like when I listen to you sing, and especially with Renaissance, it seems like an angel's voice come from above on earth for us. And that's always how your voice has been to me. So thanks for spending this time with us. Oh, and I've waited, 50 years or almost 50 years to say this to you. But I love you, Annie.
Oh. I'm embarrassed. I'm blushing.
Thanks again to Annie Haslam, one of my favorite singers of all time. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk with musician and inventor Daniel Belker to talk about a device he helped create to deliver a musical experience to the hearing impaired. Check out Annie Haslam and Renaissance's live performance of the song Scheherazade at Carnegie Hall in 1976. And we're back. This is Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlohm. Our next guest is a person whose description is kind of hard to pin down. Brazilian-born artist, musician, and engineer Daniel Belker has long been fascinated by the vibrational aspect of music. A few years ago, he turned his interest into helping to develop haptic vests, devices that produce an augmented reality based on vibrations that can be used from gaming to concerts, and have been especially of interest for making concerts accessible to the hearing impaired. Belker joined us recently from his home in Philadelphia to talk about his work. Daniel, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And how would you describe what you do?
I usually like to call myself an intermediate artist, you know, just because I like to combine different forms of expression into whatever I'm doing, you know. So I come from a multitude of backgrounds, but my main focus was always music and, you know, technology and theater. But then, you know, due to the ways we evolved, I started also doing, you know, DIY electronics and programming on the side as well.
Well, one of the things we're interested in hearing your take on is the idea of using vibrations to experience music for people who may not be able to pick up sound normally, like, you know, people who are deaf or even have hearing problems. How did you first get interested in that?
So I have a master's degree in theater, and my thesis was around listening. So I was always very intrigued by the concept of listening and not listening by opposition, right? I was always very intrigued by this idea of people not being able to hear sounds, right? And then I also had this, because of the music and everything, this idea that somehow everything is in motion, right? Things vibrate. Like if you go to the macro level, like the, you know, the stars and the galaxies and everything is moving extremely fast, and the molecules in the micro side of things, everything is vibrating and moving, right? So I was always fascinated by this. And when I was still living in Brazil, I started doing a few experiments by vibrating glass and pianos and whatnot to try to produce speakers out of regular objects in order to use into my theatrical productions. And then I moved to the US and I was working at Harvest Works in New York, and I was approached by, you know, a friend of a friend who was looking for somebody to take on this idea from the company based in California called Not Impossible Labs. And they wanted to create a better live music experience for the deaf and hard of hearing through vibrations, right? So that seemed like completely aligned with what I was interested in. So I jumped in, and it's been 8 years now in this crazy roller coaster.
And how do you go about translating music into vibrations that can be felt by somebody wearing one of these vests, what's called a haptic vest or a garment? Because I know it's a big thing now in virtual reality and gaming. People are using them for all kinds of things. But for as far as the experience of music goes, how do you go about translating music, which is in essence is vibrations, of course, but how do you go about translating those into vibrations that you can feel, and what frequencies do you use and that kind of thing? Are they the same?
No. So that's a very interesting question, and one that is in the core of what I have been researching for the past 8 years of my life, right? Because at first, when I started, the hardware part, the technical part, you know, using microcontrollers and stuff, it was not easy, but relatively simple to come about, right? You have tutorials, you have, you know, technologies available. The problem was the experience in itself, right? Because people at the time, this we're talking about the beginning of 2014, people are saying like, yeah, maybe vibrations and music are going to become a new form of ASL or maybe Braille or Morse code, right? People understand it and they feel it. But I was always very uncomfortable with this idea, because coming from an artistic background, I always felt like music had to be like a visceral experience, right? If you had to go to like a university and spend, you know, a year or so, like just understanding what is the relationship, it seems like prose and not poetry. You know, like you can go through the narrative and you can understand the meaning, but I was interested in something, you know, a little less rationally structured and more of like a really impactful experience to, you know, leverage what music usually does for hearing people, right?
Yeah, because I was just going to say that, you know, for me, you know, when I listen to music, and I love all kinds of different music, but the music I enjoy the most is one that makes me feel emotional. Like at all, you know, I've heard some music that, you know, I'll literally be on a state of tears, you know, and it's not like I'm unhappy or anything. It's just that I've been moved by a piece of music. That's got to be very difficult to translate.
Absolutely. So that was my whole struggle in the first. It took me more than a year, you know, to understand how to make one thing relate to the other. Because I completely agree with you. Actually, I had one experience like that yesterday. You know, I was listening to a song from a band that I just learned about called Beauty Pill. I became friends with the leader of the band, a great guy called Chad Clark. And I was listening to one of his songs and I was brought to tears. I was like, this is so beautiful, you know, and it's something you cannot explain properly, but in words, it just diminishes the experience if you just try to talk it, right? So I wanted to have something similar. And that was what really took me a long, long time. And things started falling into place when I realized that because I was working with a completely different sense, you know, the sense of touch, you know, not to get too technical, but on a healthy adult, our hearing range goes, you know, on average from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz, right? That's the classic. Mm-hmm.
Vibrations per second. And feel free to get technical. We're a science show.
Okay, beautiful. So, okay, 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz cycles per second. Like, so the time we have the waves, you know, vibrating up and down in a second. The skin, let's say we started more or less the same area, 20 hertz, less than that, and even less than 10, you don't feel like vibrating. It's almost like poking, you know? But there's a cutoff on your skin at 1,000 hertz, right? And pitch discrimination gets super tricky after, you know, above 250 hertz or around that. So the range that we have in terms of frequency is way more limited, right? The representation of timbre, this is completely, it's very hard to achieve, you know. It's not, the sense of touch was not designed that way. But there are other things that the skin does really well, right? So if you think about the concept of sound and a pause or a silence, the skin can perceive that extremely well. If you have vibrations and then you suddenly stop, this is very clear. Other thing that the skin does really well is the sense of localization, right? Because if you have something happening on your wrist and then on your back, you can know immediately. But it has a little more complexity because you have different senses in different areas of your body, right? Like the hands are extremely sensitive to vibration. Your back, not so much in terms of accuracy, you know. They have a model called homunculus sensorium, which is basically a model of like a human body. And the areas are enhanced to represent the areas of the skin that are more sensitive, right? So you have huge lips, you have huge hands and whatnot, and you have like a small torso. So there's a lot of things you have to take into consideration when you are designing for the sense of touch. But once you depart from the idea that this is a byproduct of music, and instead it's an art form of itself on its own, right? It's what I have been calling the art of haptics, TAO for shorts. Then things start to get really interesting, because you don't have to represent just the lower frequencies anymore, because they are what you feel in terms of vibration in the physical world, right? If you are if you feel like a thunderstorm, or if you are in an electronic music show or whatever, the speakers are loud and you really feel the bass punching, you are not constrained by that anymore, right? Because you're not trying to replicate music. You're trying to please the sense of touch and elicit emotions and create an expressive and artistic experience using the sense of touch. And now things get really interesting and the doors open, because basically you are doing something that can be used in tandem with music to potentialize the experience, but it can also achieve more than that. It can create a whole new layer of sensory experience to the user. And now it's completely accessible, because it's not just for the deaf and hard of hearing, but for everyone, right? And that's where we're at right now. So obviously there are a lot of uses for VR, AR, you know, gaming, as you mentioned, and even on the wellness side. But our focus has been extremely strong on the idea of to use our wearables as a musical instrument for professional composers and designers to achieve something really impactful, having the sense of touch as a new canvas for artistic expression.
So that was really interesting. And so it makes me wonder, you know, as an artist, you can compose things that are, you know, for this haptic experience. Has that evolved with you, where you've learned to compose different suites of vibrations, if you will?
So a few years ago, we were invited to participate in the Lady Gaga's dive bar tour launch in Nashville. And they had we had 12 deaf participants there, right? Like feeling the experience with the audience, and they were wearing what we had at the time, which were actually vests. She was doing the show twice, and there was a 4-hour gap in between each show. You know, you couldn't leave the premises, because it was, you know, a crazy thing, like helicopters flying and police cars and everything. So there was me, you know, my team, and 12 deaf participants there, just like bored, right? Like, well, what should we do? Uh-huh. And then it's like, there's no music playing. So I had this idea. So I got a MIDI controller and I started like creating the vibrations with no sounds, but just playing the vibrations in their bodies. And they started dancing and laughing and having a great time. And for the people who were passing by and watching them, it sounded very weird because there was no music, but they were dancing in rhythm.
Uh-huh.
And having this great time like a party, but you couldn't hear any music. They didn't have headphones, you know, like you're doing a silent disco. So it was kind of this surreal experience that for me was a very strong realization that this could be, you know, something composed. And we actually recorded, you know, the files that I improvised on that day. And then I started working towards, you know, a software to allow people, not just me, but whoever wanted to participate, creating, you know, compositions for the system.
Thanks again to our guests, musician and engineer Daniel Belker and Annie Haslam, the lead singer for the progressive art rock band Renaissance. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at blue.nspr. Our social media coordinator is Angela Osterello. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.